Europe, in early 1939, was, in Stalin's own words, a poker game with three players. The fascists of Nazi Germany, the capitalists of Chamberlain's Britain, allied with the Ladiers France, and the Bolsheviks. Each hoped to persuade the other two to destroy one another, leaving the third to take the winnings. Although Stalin appreciated the danger of a militarily resurgent Germany and the hostility of fascism, he regarded the Western democracies as at least as dangerous. He had matured politically during their intervention in the Civil War. He instinctively felt that he could work with Hitler. When Stalin concentrated on diplomacy, he first aimed his guns at his own diplomats. On the night of the 3rd of May 1939, NKVD troops surrounded the Foreign Commissariat. Molotov, Beria, and Malenkov arrived to inform Maxim Papasha-Litvinov, the worldly rambunctious champion of European peace through collective security, that he had been sacked. The new foreign commissar was Premier Molotov. Stalin emerged from the terror more paranoid and more confident, a state of mind that made him, if anything, less equipped to analyze the dangerous international situation. "Stalin does not know the West," thought Litvinov. "If our opponents were a bunch of shahs and sheikhs, he'd outwit them." Nor were his two main advisers, Molotov and Zhdanov, any better qualified. Stalin educated himself by reading history, particularly Bismarck's memoirs. But he did not realize that the Iron Chancellor was a conventional statesman compared to Hitler. Stalin and Molotov developed into an international double act of increasing subtlety, masters of the old good cop, bad cop routine. Stalin was always more radical and reckless, Molotov the stolid analyst of the possible, but neither saw any contradiction between imperial expansionism and their Marxist crusade. On the contrary, the former was the best way to empower the latter. Hitler kept Stalin at arm's length as long as the democracies continued to appease him. But the Munich Agreement convinced Stalin that the West was not serious about stopping Hitler. On the contrary, Stalin was sure that they were willing to let Hitler destroy Soviet Russia. Stalin warned the West that the Soviet Union would not be left to pick their chestnuts out of the fire. The way forward was a division of the world into spheres. This was an oblique signal to Germany that he would deal with whoever would deal with him. Berlin noted the change. A terror was launched against the diplomatic corps, a move designed to appeal to Hitler. "Purge the Ministry of Jews," Stalin said. "Clean out the synagogue." As Molotov, married to a Jewish woman, explained, "Jews formed an absolute majority and many ambassadors." Stalin was an anti-Semite by most definitions, but until after the war, it was more a Russian mannerism than a dangerous obsession. He was never a biological racist like the Nazis. However, he disliked any nationality that threatened loyalty to the multinational USSR. Stalin and his Jewish comrades, like Kaganovich, were proudly internationalist, but he was always suspicious because the Jews lacked a homeland, which made them mystical, intangible, otherworldly. Yet Kaganovich insisted that Stalin's view was formed by the Jewishness of his enemies, Trotsky, Zinoviev, and Kamenev. On the other hand, most of the women around him and many of his closest collaborators, from Yagoda to Merklis, were Jewish. The difference is obvious. He hated the intellectual Trotsky, but had no problem with the cobbler Kaganovich. Stalin was aware that his regime had to make a stand against anti-Semitism, and we find in his own notes a reminder to give a speech about it. He called it cannibalism, made it a criminal offense, and regularly criticized anti-Semites. Stalin realized that while he had to be seen to oppose anti-Semitism, his Jews were one obstacle to rapprochement with Hitler. The removal of the Jewish diplomats was a signal to Hitler, but Stalin always sent double messages. Molotov appointed Salomon Lazovsky, a Jew, as one of his deputies. The European poker game was played out with swift moves for vast stakes. The dictators proved much more adept at this fast-moving game than the democracies, who had started to play in earnest much too late. Hitler was raising the ante, having consumed Austria and Czechoslovakia, by turning his panzers towards Poland. Belatedly, the Western democracies realized he had to be stopped. On the 31st of March, Britain and France gathered. guaranteed the Polish borders. They needed Russia to join them, but failed to understand Stalin's sense of weakness and isolation. Ironically, the Polish guarantee increased his doubts about the depth of this British commitment. If Hitler invaded Poland, what was to stop Britain from using the guarantee as a mere bargaining chip to negotiate another Munich-style deal, leaving Hitler on Russia's borders? Stalin therefore required a military alliance with the West if he was not to turn to Hitler. Britain and France dispatched a hapless and ludicrously low-level delegation to Moscow by slow steamship to offer an alliance, but no guarantee of Soviet frontiers and no freedom of action in the Baltics, which Stalin deemed essential given the geographical vulnerability of Leningrad. Stalin was unimpressed. "They're not being serious. These people can't have the proper authority. London and Paris are playing poker again." This was now turning into an auction for Stalin's favors, but with only one serious bidder. Meanwhile, Hitler decided to invade Poland on the 26th of August. Suddenly, the agreement with Stalin was desperately necessary. The meetings with the Western delegation only got started on the 12th of August, but the gap between what the West was willing to offer and the price Stalin demanded was unbridgeable. That day, the Russians signaled to the Germans that they were ready to start negotiations, even on the dismemberment of Poland. On the 15th, the German ambassador, Schulenburg, requested a meeting with Molotov, who reported that Russia was ready. On the 17th, Voroshilov proposed a treaty of mutual military assistance to the British and French, but their delegation had not yet received its orders. "Enough of these games," Stalin told Molotov. On the afternoon of Saturday the 19th, Molotov hurriedly summoned Schulenburg, handing him a draft non-aggression pact. Having signed the trade treaty that Stalin had specified was necessary before the real business could begin, the Germans, whose deadline was fast approaching, waited with a gambler's anticipation. Hitler shrewdly decided to cut the Gordian knot of mutual trust and prestige by personally addressing Stalin in a telegram dated 20th of August. "Dear Mr. Stalin." Suddenly, the two dictators were no longer holding back, but hurtling towards one another, arms outstretched. Next day, Voroshilov dismissed the British and French. Stalin's agreement to receive Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, reached Hitler at 8:30 that evening. "Marvelous! I congratulate you," declaimed Hitler, adding with the flashiness of the entertainer, "I have the world in my pocket." That night, Voroshilov was leading a vital delegation of the Soviet leadership on a duck-shooting expedition. Before setting off to shoot duck, Khrushchev dined with Stalin at the dacha. It was then that Stalin informed him that Ribbentrop was arriving imminently. Khrushchev, who knew nothing about the negotiations, was dumbfounded. "Why should Ribbentrop want to see us?" Khrushchev blurted out. "Is he defecting?" Then he remembered that he was going hunting. Should he cancel? "Go right ahead," said Stalin. "There'll be nothing for you to do. Molotov and I will meet Ribbentrop. When you return, I'll let you know what Hitler has in mind." Perhaps it was that night that Stalin, reading Vipper's History of Ancient Greece, marked the passage about the benefits of dictators working closely together. On the 23rd of August, Ribbentrop was driven through the Spassky Gate to the little corner, where he found Stalin in party tunic and baggy trousers tucked into boots, and Molotov in a dark suit. They swiftly agreed to the terms of their pact, which was designed to divide Poland and Eastern Europe into spheres of influence. Stalin got Eastern Poland, Latvia, Estonia, Finland and Bessarabia in Romania, though Hitler kept Lithuania. But when Ribbentrop proposed a paean to German-Soviet friendship, Stalin snorted, "Don't you think we have to pay a little more attention to public opinion in our two countries? For many years now we have been pouring buckets of shit over each other's head. Now, all of a sudden, are we to make our people believe all is forgotten and forgiven? Things don't work so fast." Ribbentrop returned to his embassy to telegraph Hitler. When he arrived back at the little corner, he announced that Hitler approved the terms. A sudden tremor seemed to go through Stalin, and he did not immediately grasp the hand proffered by Ribbentrop. It was as if he had first to overcome a moment of fear. Photographers arrived, and a maid brought in champagne and snacks. When one of the German photographers took Stalin and Ribbentrop raising their glasses, the former shook his finger and told him he did not want such a photograph published. The photographer offered to hand over his film, but Stalin said he could trust the word of a German. At 3 a.m., as they parted, Stalin told Ribbentrop, "I can guarantee on my word of honor that the Soviet Union will not betray its partner." Stalin headed to Kuntsevo, where the hunters awaited. As they feasted on duck, Stalin boasted, "Of course, it's all a game, to see who can fool whom. I know what Hitler's up to. He thinks he's outsmarted me, but actually, it's I who's tricked him. War," he explained, "would pass us by a little longer." The Great Game, as Molotov called the tournament of nerves between Stalin and Hitler, had begun. On the 1st of September, Paskryobyshev handed Stalin a telegram from Berlin, informing him that early that evening Polish troops, in fact German security forces in disguise, had attacked the German radio station in Gliwice. Stalin left for the dacha and went to bed. A few hours later, Paskryobyshev called again. Germany had invaded Poland. Stalin monitored the campaign as Britain and France declared war on Germany, honoring their guarantees. Stalin planned the Soviet invasion of Poland with Voroshilov, Shaposhnikov, and Kulik, who was to command the front along with Mechlis. At 2 a.m. on the 17th of September, Stalin, accompanied by Molotov and Voroshilov, told Schulenburg, 4 hours from now, the Red Army will cross into Poland." Premier Molotov took to the radio to announce the sacred duty to proffer help to Ukrainian and Belarusian brothers. Mechlis claimed to Stalin that the West Ukrainians welcomed the Soviet troops like true liberators. Many weep with joy. Khrushchev, Ukrainian First Secretary, donned a military uniform and, accompanied by his NKVD boss, Ivan Sirov, joined the forces of Semyon Timoshenko, commander of the Kiev military district. Khrushchev's advance into Poland was an adventure for him, but even more so for his wife. Nina Petrovna, also sporting military uniform and a pistol, liberated her own parents, who had remained in Poland since 1920. If the Soviet invasion was joyous for the Khrushchevs, it unleashed depredations on the Polish population every bit as cruel and tragic as those of the Nazis. Khrushchev ruthlessly suppressed any sections of the population who might oppose Soviet power. Priests, officers, noblemen, intellectuals were kidnapped, murdered, and deported to eliminate the very existence of Poland. By November 1940, one-tenth of the population, or 1,170,000 innocents, had been deported. 30% of them were dead by 1941. 50,000 were shot. The Soviets behaved like conquerors. On the 27th of September, Ribbentrop flew back to negotiate the notorious protocols. Stalin wanted Lithuania. Ribbentrop telegraphed Hitler for his permission, so the talks were delayed until the next day. That night, Stalin held a gala dinner for the Germans to celebrate the carve-up of Europe. The Nazis were dazzled by the scarlet and gold reception room where Stalin, Molotov, and the Politburo awaited them. The Germans noticed how respectful the Russians were to Stalin. The fear surrounding him had become intense since 1937. While the guests were chatting, Stalin went into the sumptuous Andreevsky Hall to check the seating plan, a task which he enjoyed doing even at Kuntsevo. The 22 guests were dwarfed by the grandeur of the hall, the colossal flower arrangements, the imperial gold cutlery, and even more by the 24 courses and lashings of pepper vodka and Crimean champagne. Before anyone could eat, Molotov started to propose toasts to each guest. It was an exhausting rigmarole that would become one of the diplomatic tribulations of the war. When Molotov had run through every guest, the Germans sighed with relief until he announced, "Now we'll drink to all members of the delegations who couldn't attend this dinner." Stalin took over. He toasted Kaganovich, our People's Commissar of Railways. Stalin deliberately rose and circled the table to clink glasses so that Ribbentrop had to follow suit and drink to a Jew, an irony that amused Stalin. When Ribbentrop noticed how well Stalin was bearing the toasts, he cheerfully revealed that he was drinking white wine, not vodka. At the end of the dinner, the Germans were dispatched to the Bolshoi to watch Swan Lake. Stalin and Molotov excused themselves and walked upstairs to where the Estonian foreign minister miserably waited for Stalin to emasculate his little Baltic nation. Molotov demanded a Soviet garrison of 35,000 troops, more than the entire Estonian army. "Come on, Molotov, you're rather harsh on our friends," said Stalin, suggesting 25,000, but the effect was much the same. Having swallowed a country during the first act of Swan Lake, Stalin returned to the Germans at midnight for a final session, during which Hitler telephoned his agreement to the Lithuanian concession. "Hitler knows his business," muttered Stalin. When Ribbentrop suggested Russia joining a military alliance against the West, Stalin just said, "I shall never allow Germany to become weak." He obviously believed that Germany would be restrained in the West by Britain and France. When the maps were finally ready in the early hours, Stalin signed them in blue crayon, with a massive signature 10 inches long, an inch high, and a tail 18 inches long. "Is my signature clear enough for you?"